This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Hello and welcome back to episode 2 of the Equal Agenda podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Imi.
And I'm Roman, and this episode is going to be about war and conflict. I've not had much experience with war. I don't know about you. I don't know if you've been in any wars.
I have not.
But you hear about them quite often.
Yeah.
Recently, what's happening in Iran started with strikes from the US and Israel, and oil prices went just through the roof.
Yes. Crazy. You're telling me $4? That's crazy.
No, but definitely I think war
is much deeper than just oil prices and cost of living and what's going on. What we see the media presenting today, does it always tell the full story about what is going on behind the scenes of a war? I don't think so.
I think a lot of people would be inclined to say that war is largely good for nothing.
Yeah.
It's good for no one. I don't actually know if I subscribe to that point of view.
Okay.
And that's not like, I'm not saying, you know, bomb Iran. Let's start just bombing China. I think that there are legitimate reasons to use violence. Now, that might sound a bit radical, but if we look back on, say, the civil rights movement in the United States, right? You had Martin Luther King, and he was a really good example of nonviolent resistance, and it was in securing the rights of African Americans. There was also Malcolm X. And both of those figures worked together to sort of secure their rights, right? And near the end of his life, Martin Luther King Jr. was actually more ideologically similar to Malcolm X by the time that he died. So I think that just being opposed to war because, oh, it's not a very womanly thing. It's not like, as I know that in a lot of feminist theory, there is opposition to war. I'm not particularly convinced that that's always a good thing. I think that in certain cases, yeah, women should have a right to fight, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the quote that outrageous things warrant outrageous reactions. And I think that often wars are caused by stuff going on in the background. And it's kind of presented as this, oh, like, this is just happening. But I mean, personally in school, I didn't learn much about the history, about why these kind of things were going on. And I feel like this episode is, we're kind of tying in, like, how does this relate to women and feminism? Because war is such a big thing throughout history. Like, it's happened in the past, it's happening now, like, it's always going to be there. You can't just get rid of it whether you like it or not. I guess it's just kind of having a bit more education on, like, what role do women play in war, I guess.
Yeah, and I think they play a lot of roles. They can be victims of war. That's a very big problem with most wars, that women and children especially find themselves at the center of that and at the center of a lot of the violence that happens. But there's also the potential for women to actually wage war themselves. There are women warlords and there are women who fight in the military. There are women who command in the military. Speaking of, actually, we have a historical figure that we'd like to introduce for this week. This is a new thing that we're doing.
Yeah.
Every week we'll introduce a historical woman of note that's relevant to the topic that we're doing. And this one for this week is Joan of Arc. Now, a lot of people listening might know Joan of Arc. Some people might not. She's a famous historical figure, a military figure in France during the Hundred Years' War. So she was an illiterate peasant girl, which sort of ties in to ideas about intersectionality. This is her class alongside her gender that actually make what she did so, I guess, surprising.
Yeah.
So this 16-year-old girl couldn't read, essentially says, well, yeah, I saw a bunch of angels and they said that, you know, I've got to lead France in the war, because they were doing pretty horrible at the time. And so the king at the time, Charles VII, just said, yeah, right, you're in charge of the armies. And she became a pretty distinguished military commander and pretty much turned the tide of the war, of the Hundred Years' War, which led to French victory eventually. Notably at the Battle of Orléans, she led a charge and used pretty novel tactics that the French then later adopted to help themselves win the war. Eventually, though, she was captured by the English and tried for being a witch and burnt at the stake.
Whoa.
You get more into sort of, yeah, the gendered aspect of it and the fact that they couldn't tolerate the fact that this lady was, you know, kicking their asses.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, call her a witch, burn her at the stake. Because at the time, there were, like, you know, there were codes of chivalry. Like, if a guy was captured in battle, like a rival lord, he was, you know, he was a lord. You were a lord. Sort of like, you know, you got a lot in common. Bro code. Yeah, essentially the bro code, literally the bro code, because it didn't apply to her.
Yeah.
And when they captured her, they burnt her.
That's crazy. Immediately, that just makes me think of, because obviously this war had been going on for like 100 years or so to say, like a long time. I don't know the exact amount.
16 years?
That's crazy. And the fact that they were like so kind of over it and like lost all hope that, oh, they were willing to employ a woman to sort it out. That is just the fact that that was their last resort almost. That's kind of crazy. And she actually did help them out and kind of sorted it out for them.
Like she proved that, you know, women are actually capable.
Yeah.
She went beyond that because she practically won the war for them. But another thing was that while she was fighting, she would wear what were considered men's clothes or like men's dresses, men's armor, stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
And that's one of the reasons why the English tried her as a witch, is because the idea of this woman wearing men's clothes was essentially to them unnatural. And there are stories about her being imprisoned in jail and they would intentionally take away her dresses so she'd have nothing else to wear but men's clothes, but like pants and stuff. So then they could say, well, look, she's not even listening to us. She doesn't want to wear dresses, so we have to burn her.
Oh, my goodness. Just the fact that they literally, like, there's no possible way we could have been beaten by a woman. She must be a witch. Like, she cannot be equal to us. That is crazy.
It's just insane. And the fact that, yeah, their whole excuse was, yeah, well, she wears pants, so we've got to kill her.
Oh, my God.
Like, you think, like, now, you know, there are ridiculous social expectations. At the time, if a woman wore pants, well, that's it. You know, you're burning at the stake.
That's insane.
But, yeah, I guess so. Joan of Arc is a great example to illustrate how women can very easily assume leadership positions in times of war. I think we've seen it over and over again. We see figures like Margaret Thatcher. So she went to war in the Falklands in the 80s. Mm. And she had this idea of, or this idea that formed around her, that she was the Iron Lady. And I think Thatcher is a great example to illustrate how women in these leadership positions, especially ones that involve things like leading during times of war, they assume, I guess, what is considered to be very masculine positions. And that's because I think war is a very gendered thing. There's a lot of masculinization that goes on.
Yeah, 100%. So just to kind of build off of that, I would definitely say that the way that war is been seen throughout history and the way that it's presented even today, I'm going to draw off a theory by Kimberly Hutchins, and I'll link it in the comments if you're interested in reading more. But it's basically the idea that masculinity provides a framework to make sense of conflict, and that hegemonic masculinity, which if you didn't know, hegemonic masculinity is a term used in gender studies and sociology and a lot of the social sciences, but it basically is the dominant form of masculinity that we see in society today. So think of your like typical manly man that you would kind of be seen promoted in the media, like someone who is big and muscly and doesn't show their emotions and thinks that crying makes them weak, that kind of thing. And it's not necessarily a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing all the time, but it's the dominant form of masculinity that we see. And so I would argue that hegemonic masculinity encourages war and that you're seen as more of a man if you're doing these kind of fighting roles, and that in order for wars to kind of endure and carry on throughout history, it requires the production and reproduction of masculine men, to function as an institution. Because I would argue that war in itself is kind of an institution. Like, it's like thing created, and you need the support of like others to keep it kind of going.
And that's, I think that's really interesting, especially because I think the primary way that we see or define war is the diplomatic, I guess, tool that states wield against each other. So there's other forms of conflict, there's crises. So you have, rebel groups going around countries like the Maoists in India or the Philippines as well. But typically when we think of war, it's two states going at it with organized militaries. And within these organized militaries, within these states themselves, I think you see there's a lot of patriarchal systems involved.
Yeah. And when you think about these armies and like war itself, even if you are thinking about women in it, it's often viewed as women who are very masculine. They're still described using masculinity. They're not necessarily portrayed by the media as feminine women.
On that, though, I think there is like a sort of feminine role, I think, that gets ascribed to a lot of women in war. The Second World War is a great example because there were millions of women across pretty much all of the players of the war that enlisted in the military. A lot of those women weren't allowed in combat roles. It was mostly things like nursing, like logistics, so like driving trucks and stuff. Florence Nightingale is an example of sort of the myth of the caring woman who's, you know, thrust into war to take care of all of the poor wounded men.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that in my eyes, I've kind of got two like separate categories of the ways that women have interacted in kind of wars. And I would say that there's definitely the category of the outlying woman in combat situations. Like, it's not the norm. Like, it's not seen as a norm. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a good thing. I'm just saying that that's kind of like when you hear about these people like Joan of Arc or like historic figures throughout time, it's kind of like a, whoa, like, it's like you wouldn't have expected that, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but I think that's actually a really common thing for women essentially to step up during war.
Yeah.
Again, back to the World War II example, women in industry. Most of the men were going overseas to fight and die in wars because a lot of women weren't allowed to. But domestically, women were encouraged to go into factories and replace the men who had gone to fight that obviously were not working anymore.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of the whole idea that during war you see, you know, men being conscripted and like enlisted in the wars. Recruitment is focused around male, like strong men. You have to have a certain physique. You have to look a certain way. You have to have a certain fitness. And those are kind of, you see like, oh, the heroes of our countries. And then they, you know, they come back and there's a lot of support needed because they've gone through terrible things, you know, rates of PTSD. And that's all kind of what is majorly promoted via war. But I think that a lot of stuff that goes behind the scenes is the invisibility of women's service during revolutions and conflicts. Mm-hmm. It's often unseen, the kind of caregiving and emotional labor that goes on. I feel like now we're kind of seeing women get more of the recognition they deserve, but I would assume that back in the day, it was just expected for women to step up as nurses and to step up in terms of like, come on now, you've got to have more babies. We need some more men for the war. Like, in my mind, that's crazy. I can't even imagine having to do that.
Yeah, it's especially, I guess, jarring to see that during times of war, states can actually be quite flexible in what they allow women to do and what they try to prevent women from doing. You see really how, I guess, flimsy the gender norms are. When you have, say, Britain initially essentially forbidding women from working in jobs like this, most women weren't in that kind of manual labor. And then suddenly, when they need them, when they realize that actually gender equality, gender equity is necessary for a more peaceful, a more prosperous nation, once you actually get half the population rights that they need to actually contribute to society, you get economic benefits, you get security benefits, you get all sorts of things that you're just blindly throwing away. And they realize that during wartime. And then once they're back to peace, you see this in the UK, they took all women out of service and then women were encouraged to go back to, say, marriage because that was their traditional role.
Yeah. And just kind of going back to how society views war as a whole, I'm just thinking of toys that like kids play with, of soldiers and stuff. Personally, I've always only seen like males and kind of like big tanks, the big guns, all that kind of stuff going on.
Yeah, like G.I. Joe's.
Yeah. It's not often like a celebrated thing, the femininity that women bring to war and how that can kind of help in conflict. Because I feel like, genuinely, this is a big claim to make, but I would, again, like coming back to the theory of that war is inherently masculine and it's inherently a kind of thing that comes about because, I don't want to say because of men, but I would also say that historically we can kind of see that majority of wars have been caused by male leaders and that the conflicts themselves.
I mean, I think, yeah, there is a gendering of war, a massive gendering of war,
yeah.
Where it is encouraged from a very early age, like you said, with toys.
Yeah.
Kids are encouraged, you know, play with swords or even like toy guns and stuff like that. A lot of video games, like Call of Duty. And it's not necessarily the fact that, oh, you know, video games cause violence. That's not exactly what I'm saying. What I'm saying is they're all part of that sort of implicit, almost insidious masculinization of war, where they work together to sort of form this idea of war as a masculine thing, a thing for men. You have depictions of men going off to war to protect their children. In the ancient world, at least, when we're talking about ancient warfare, so that's like the Greeks and stuff. When they would go on long expeditions, they would actually bring women with them as sort of mobile households, essentially, so that they could fulfill their own needs. And that's a thing that you see a lot. Because to me, that's a pretty, again, it's a pretty jarring thing. It's almost like bringing them along like livestock, right?
Yeah. Like, crazy.
But that's a thing that has continued even beyond the ancient world. In Japan, during the Second World War, they had this happened so frequently that it was given a name. Comfort women were essentially women throughout Asia that were abducted and made to sort of work as prostitutes within the Japanese army. And this is recent. This is the 1940s, so that's like not even 100 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I had no idea about that. That's really interesting. I guess that kind of is like going on to the next thing of like kind of the objectification. We've already discussed it a little bit, but objectification of women during wartime. And Martha Thompson in Women, Gender and Conflict talks about it a little bit. And there's another example that's very similar to the one that you gave of the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, and various armed groups in the Eastern Congo have had cases of kidnapping girls and women to use them in roles like cooking and cleaning. Like, that is just crazy to me. You're just treating them like pawns, like to use in a game that they never signed up for in the first place. And I think that's the point I was kind of trying to make before, is that I don't think, in my mind, I can't picture female leaders dealing with issues or dealing with arguments or disagreements using violence and combat. Like, I think that is an inherently male thing to do. But I don't know if you agree with that.
I don't know, because there actually have been a lot of examples of female leaders sort of taking on roles like that. There's a big example, Olga of Kiev. This is more of a historical one. She's actually a saint, I'm pretty sure. But she was a pretty ruthless ruler. She would kill and burn down cities pretty much indiscriminately. She was actually famous for burning down a city. I think it was a group of people called the Drevlians, actually. And she, they sent a delegation to her saying, hey, we want to be allies with you. Do you want to marry a guy that's like one of our nobility so that we can cement an alliance? And she was like, I'm not marrying a guy for you guys. And so she trapped the delegation in a bathhouse and set the bathhouse on fire with the guys inside. And then she went to the Drevlian capital and set that on fire as well. So I think...
Damn!
it's pretty ruthless. I couldn't imagine myself doing anything near that brutal. But I think what it is maybe not so much femininity, but just sort of, and again, looking at it through an intersectional lens, just the power that comes with being in a leadership position in a world where international relations is so heavily masculinized. I think a good way to visualize it, at least in the modern sense, is that a lot of wars, and you see this a lot with the United States, there's sort of an imperialist tendency that goes along with it. So if you look at Vietnam, if you look at the Korean War, if you look at, you know, various interventions in Latin America, there's essentially, it's the US imposing its will on other countries. It's saying, well, this is how we want the world to be. This is what we're going to do. Coming around with a big stick and essentially hitting everyone who's not in line. And there is the patriarchal element to that imperialism because it comes with the sort of structures of power. There was actually an interesting study that I found titled Introducing the Women's Activities in Armed Rebellion Project from 1946 to 2015 by Meredith Loken and Hilary Matfess. So essentially what it was tracking women's involvement in specifically rebel groups and revolutionary movements around the world. And it found that from that period, 1946 to 2015, 63% of these groups had women's participation in some form. And in a lot of these cases, it was combat roles. So you would have women who would essentially be on equal footing with men in these groups, essentially just fighting for whatever cause I guess they believed in. And it obviously differs between, say, like if it's a radical Islamist revolutionary group compared to, I think most commonly it was leftist groups who have a lot of women in their ranks. There's Maoists in the Philippines who also have a lot of women. I think actually it was those Filipino Maoists that officiated the first, I believe it was lesbian marriage in the Philippines. And then other groups like far-right groups, Islamist groups, had low to virtually zero women in their ranks.
Well,
yeah, I think that goes on to what I was talking about, like imperialism and stuff, where you have a lot of rebel groups that have a lot of women, but then a lot of countries with organized militaries have little to no female participation. So I think you've got to look at the relations of power that are going on there. Why are these military groups so involved with female membership while these other ones are either not interested in it or actively denying it?
Yeah. So I think we've covered a lot. We've talked about kind of specific examples of women in wars, in combat roles, like where you were just talking about rebel groups. We've discussed kind of war being tied to masculinity itself and how that kind of comes about and the interactions there. Then we've also discussed a little bit of the objectification of women during war, like whether this is like forcing them to reproduce so that there can be more men for armies, or just the caregiving and emotional labor that goes on behind the scenes. We've kind of talked a little bit about whether or not we think war itself is a very like masculine thing, or is it a feminine thing? We'd love to know what you guys think. Do you think that war is something that comes about because of men and masculinity itself? Or do you think that there is a big space for women, and women do play a huge, well, obviously they play a huge part. We've learned that today. But do you think that is inherently actually a feminine role in war? But just kind of building off that,
a thing that we didn't actually touch on was women after war. So women,
yes,
in the peace process. And this was, yeah, another statistic that I see brought up a lot in the UN, is that in any case where women are meaningfully involved in the peace building process, so like making peace agreements and stuff, these agreements are 35% more likely to last longer than 15 years. So when you actually meaningfully involve women, when you prioritize gender equality and you have the voices of women platformed and actually given equal weight to the voices of men in these processes, you get a more peaceful, a more secure, a more stable world. And that might not necessarily be because of anything inherently feminine, but there's also the idea of, again, intersectionality. A lot of women, especially in these areas where peace building is needed, will be marginalized. They will be lower class. And so they bring these lower class perspectives to the table, which I think is really important, especially in peace building.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's kind of what I was trying to talk about before, but I obviously didn't know as much as you do. You're very knowledgeable about this topic, so I'm grateful for that. But I think in my mind, I personally, I'm very against war, and I don't think that it is really needed for these solutions to come about. But I think that it is very important for women to play a large role in the peace side of war, because I think that you're 100% correct. Positive change and like substantial change that's going to be lasting comes about when we're including all perspectives and all opinions of everyone involved in conflict or war. They need to be involved in the solution process. And just a fun little bit that I was going to talk about earlier, but I kind of forgot. There's an example specific to Aotearoa, which I think would be quite interesting to include. This is an example of kind of conflict resolution through like peaceful protests. So perfect. So the example I wanted to talk about was actually Parihaka. So if you don't know, Parihaka was one of the first peaceful protests like ever, and it actually inspired Mahatma Gandhi. So basically Parihaka was in the 1880s around then, and it was an example in Aotearoa in Taranaki. So Parihaka was set up to be this kind of refuge for displaced iwi, displaced Māori, and it was led by Te Whiteo Rongomai and Tohu Kākahi. So basically they led this kind of peaceful protest when British troops were trying to invade Parihaka and take it for land. So they were surveying the land using surveying pegs, and the peaceful protest was they just removed the surveying pegs. But again, the British kept coming back and they really were determined to get this land. And when the British troops came fully armed with their kind of muskets and whatnot, coming onto the settlement on their horses, they were met by women and children. And that's why I think that this is such an amazing example, and a lot of people in New Zealand should learn about this, is that the women and children were sent out first to greet the soldiers in order to give them a sense of safety and a sense of kind of peacefulness. And I think that this is a really cool example because it just shows the way in which feminine energy can be used to create a kind of more peaceful atmosphere, if that makes sense. By sending out women and children, they were trying to get the message across that they weren't here for war, they weren't here for conflict, they were here for peace. They just wanted their land, and yeah, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I would say I think it makes good use of that sort of masculinization, where essentially, at least especially at the time, because this was ages ago, women were not seen as a threat in war. They were often seen as either the victims or the people you needed to protect.
Yeah.
And so I think harnessing that perception and those sort of gendered norms around war to encourage a peaceful resolution,
yeah,
is a great use of that. That's a way that you can twist those norms against war.
Exactly. Using it to your advantage, kind of utilizing, they knew that like it wouldn't be seen as threatening to have the woman come out, and they used that to their advantage, and good on them.
Yeah, honestly, this is a great strategy, and it avoided probably a lot of bloodshed, I'd imagine.
You would think, but unfortunately
Well,
anyways, we don't have to talk about that because I feel like I could talk for ages.
But that's pretty much what we have time for.
Yeah.
There's a lot to talk about when it comes to war and women and women's roles in war, because it's not actually discussed that much.
Exactly. And there's a lot we could have covered, and we would have loved to talk about everything, especially currently, more current examples of what's going on. But we tried to keep this as like sensitive as we could and just kind of as broad as we can to include all opinions. But let us know what you thought. Do you disagree? Do you agree? Is there specific examples that you can think of where women have played a really important role in war?
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.